Hello, I'm David Lin, and I'm the curator for the gallery on the regulation of corporate disclosure that will be included in the SEC Historical Society's virtual museum and archive. Our topic for this webcast is the development and implementation of Regulation FD. I'm pleased to be joined by my panelists who each offer a very unique perspective on the adoption of Regulation FD and the lasting impact of these rules. I'm very pleased to be joined today by Linda Chapman Thompson, who's counsel at Davis Polk and who served as director of the Division of Enforcement at the SEC. Linda spent 14 years in the SEC's Division of Enforcement, and during that time she served, during the time that she served in the division, Regulation FD was adopted, and the commission brought many of its enforcement actions under Regulation FD. I'm pleased to be joined by Stork Caswell, who served as executive vice president and managing director, general counsel of the Managed Funds Association. Prior to that time, Stuart was partner at Brian Cave and Deckert, and he served as senior vice president and general counsel of the Securities Industry Association from 1994 to 2003. And during that time, he was tasked with expressing the SIA's opposition to Regulation FD at the time it was proposed and adopted. Stuart also served as counsel to the Committee on Energy and Commerce of the U.S. House of Representatives and held a number of positions at the Securities and Exchange Commission. Professor Donald Langevoort joins us. He is the Thomas Aquinas Reynolds Professor of Law at Georgetown Law. Don has served for a number of years at the SEC in the Office of General Counsel, and he's written extensively on the topic of insider trading, as well as many other corporate and securities law topics. Don is the co-author of Securities Regulation Cases and Materials and the author of the treatise entitled Insider Trading, Regulation, Enforcement, and Prevention. I'm pleased to be joined by Richard Levine, who's a partner at Labaton Sucharo. Rich served for more than three decades at the SEC. He served for much of his SEC career in the SEC's Office of General Counsel, most recently serving as Associate General Counsel for Legal Policy. Rich was the primary drafter on the team that prepared the SEC's Selective Disclosure and Insider Trading rulemaking, which ultimately resulted in the adoption of Regulation FD and Rules 10b-5-1, 10b-5-2. Thank you all for joining me today.
Happy to be here.
Regulation FD was adopted 20 years ago in August of 2000, and while the concept of avoiding selective disclosure to market professionals seems like second nature today, the adoption of Regulation FD was very controversial back in its day. During this webcast, we're going to explore the origins of Regulation FD, the rulemaking process, including the opposing viewpoints that were expressed, as well as the aftermath as the SEC sought to enforce Regulation FD over these past 20 years. I'm going to first turn over to Don, who's going to get us started with exploring the legacy of Chiarella and Dirks and how those insider trading decisions and other cases planted the seeds that ultimately sprouted as Regulation FD.
Sure, thanks. You know, as you implied, it's important to keep in mind that Reg FD is not an insider trading rule. It's not a 10B rule. It's a public disclosure rule. Yet, as you also implied, the history very much starts in the arguments about whether there should be a prohibition on insider trading, and then, more importantly, what should the prohibition be? So I want to take us back in time, and then we'll walk forward so we get to the place we were on the eve of FD's adoption. Insider trading as a violation of the federal securities laws was born in the 1960s and grew up in the 1970s. And it grew up in the context of a very vocal argument as to what should be the standard for whether some conduct constitutes insider trading. With a shove, nudge from the Second Circuit in a case called SEC versus Texas Gulf Sulfur, the court suggested that what's behind the prohibition of insider trading is equal access, that there should be an equal playing field, that everybody should have the right to the same information when they trade with each other. That was very idealistic and subject to substantial criticism by those who believe there is never such a thing as a level playing field, and you wouldn't want one because it would interfere with the mechanisms of market efficiency. That argument, which went on for a decade and a half, was finally resolved by the Supreme Court in the two cases that Dave mentioned. Chiarella versus the United States and Dirks versus the Securities and Exchange Commission. In Chiarella, the Supreme Court very much cast its lot with those who argue that an even playing field is an illusory and perhaps even dangerous idea. Rather, the court said, insider trading is fraudulent. It does violate 10b-5, but if and only if it constitutes a particular kind of wrongfulness, and that's breach of fiduciary duty. If you're breaching a fiduciary duty to those with whom you're trading because you're an officer, director, or somebody else who owes a duty of trust and confidence, you can't trade. Disclose or abstain. But if you're not, if you're engaged in some other kinds of activity, not within that sphere of wrongfulness, you're free to trade and your trading is free to drive market prices in whatever direction they properly go. So breach of fiduciary duty became the touchstone. That gets us to the securities analyst problem. Throughout the 70s, there were SEC enforcement actions, arguments about market information, and inside information that goes to market professionals. And the Supreme Court in Chiarella, having said that fiduciary duty is a touchstone, had to confront the question, what about when insiders are on the phone with investment analysts, with portfolio managers? Do the duties that accompany fiduciary obligation transfer over the telephone or in the course of face-to-face conduct to those who receive the information? That was a version of the tip or tippee problem, but a particularly vexing version of the problem. Well, all that gets resolved, at least on paper, in Dirks versus SEC. The court came back to its idea that only a breach of fiduciary duty triggers a duty to disclose, but said there are circumstances where an insider passes on information to somebody else. The duty will attach to that other person's trading, not just the insider. The court was clearly concerned about market efficiency and fair, bona fide communications to investment analysts. Concerned about that, the court said, here's our test. Both tipper and tippee, whatever the context, both tipper and tippee are going to be liable for insider trading if but only if the following. One, the tipper, the insider, is passing on the information for a personal benefit, selfishly, in breach of fiduciary duty in that regard. And secondly, the recipient of the information knows or should know that this passing on of information is wrongful, is selfish. That was the test. From that moment on, the SEC staff commission were upset. They thought personal benefit had no major place to play. And there were many people still at this time, 1983, looking back wistfully on the notion of equal access, equal playing field. This seemed to disturb it. But Justice Powell very much wanted to protect market efficiency, wanted to protect bona fide disclosures from inside to those who are professional traders and have such influence over market prices. This concern that the commission had boiled for quite a while and took all sorts of forms as the SEC tried to recapture some of that lost territory. But the notion of selective disclosure, that an insider could give material non-public information to somebody on Wall Street, somebody in the industry, so long as that passage of information wasn't selfish, personally motivated by the corporate insider, was an especially lingering problem. And so over the course of the 80s and the 90s, the SEC pushed a little. There was an enforcement action trying to expand the notion of selfish disclosures to analysts. But pretty much it was agreed that if selective disclosure went back to the courts, especially back to the Supreme Court, the answer would come through loud and clear that no, under Dirks, selective disclosure for bona fide transactions is permissible. And that set the stage. We're now in the late 1990s. The SEC had learned to live with selective disclosure as permissible in most cases under Dirks. And that's when Harvey Goldschmidt and Arthur Levitt somehow hatched the plan to take a shot at selective disclosure from a very different angle. And at this point, I just hand the story over to the next in line.
Yeah, Rich, I guess that leads us to the General Counsel's office at the SEC and dealing with an issue where obviously 10b-5 was probably not going to be the viable path given what the court had previously said in terms of the commission's authority on this point, and so a new approach needed to be determined as things evolved in the marketplace where investors became much more self-directed and less reliant on analysts' communications and the like, and there was sort of disintermediation going on in the marketplace as people had access to the internet and the like. So take us back to that time and how Reg FD was hatched.
Okay. Thank you, David. Yeah, and I think Don had taken us right to the point where this story, where my story begins. I'm going to start in February of 1998, really with a speech that Chairman Levitt gave at SEC Speaks that year, and at that time, a timely topic was insider trading because the Supreme Court's O'Hagan decision had come out the previous year in June. And Chairman Levitt's speech was called A Question of Integrity. And it's largely about insider trading. And he talks about O'Hagan. And he talks about standard insider trading fraud law. And then after picking up on O'Hagan, he segues into this issue of selective disclosure and, admitting that he's not talking about the legal niceties and ins and outs of the problems under 10b-5. His speech very forcefully talks about this from a question of fairness and integrity. And as he liked to do, he talked about town hall meetings he had had with investors and how individual investors were, passionately believed that the little guy was getting hammered by the big guy or people with better access or better connections. And in the speech, he makes a very strong case, again, not on the law, but on kind of the fairness and the equities of selective disclosure being a practice that is really harmful to public perception of the integrity of the market. And in many ways, it actually does kind of echo things that Justice Ginsburg has said in her O'Hagan opinion about how one of the guiding principles of the securities laws was to promote full and fair disclosure to promote belief in the integrity of the securities market, and how that important that was for the health of our capital market. So in the speech, Chairman Leavitt, warned that the SEC would be looking at doing things in this area. The initial follow-up was a bit to look at whether there were enforcement cases that could be brought. At the time, Harvey Goldsmith was general counsel, Dick Walker was enforcement director, he'd been the previous general counsel, and there was some focus on whether there was a way to bring some of these incidents of selective disclosure that we were aware of as enforcement cases. Don mentioned there had been one case brought years earlier where the SEC pushed back on that. It was a settlement, didn't necessarily that the law was going to go our way. And I think when we looked into trying to pursue the enforcement angle, the staff ultimately felt, as Don said, that the law was not too good. And, we might be able to bring one or two cases and succeed or get a settlement, but that it was hard to think that this was going to be the ultimate solution to try to pursue this under insider trading law. So given that the problem was the uncertainty of success in pursuing a selective disclosure case under 10b-5 insider trading law, the focus turned to doing something different. Maybe writing a rule that could get at this a different way and avoid the issues that Don explained were raised by Dirks and Chiarella. I remember Harvey Goldschmidt at one point just kind of quietly and calmly suggesting that, yeah, he thought we could fix this. He took an approach that was something like an 8K requirement, and that turned into the rulemaking project, and that was, basically my initial marching order, to kind of think of this as a rule that would create something like an 8K requirement for disclosure. As part of this rulemaking, once we got into it, we also did add in a couple of insider trading fixes. That's why the rule was, I think, officially called selective disclosure and insider trading. But I'll keep my focus on Reg FD here. So in developing the rule and kind of following up on this 8K idea, we essentially worked backwards from what we had as kind of the pre-existing 8K disclosure approach, 8K required disclosure approach, meaning that the focus was to try to come up with something that would say, here are situations where an issuer has an obligation to make a public disclosure. And the way we got it to work was to say, well, if you disclose any material non-public information to any person selectively, then essentially, as the rule developed then, it was written in a it had a fairly simple requirement and a fairly simple structure. The rule, as we ultimately proposed it, said that whenever an issuer or a person acting on behalf of the issuer discloses any material non-public information to any person outside the issuer, it then had a requirement to make public disclosure. And it could satisfy the requirement by filing an 8K, or it could satisfy it by providing disclosure through some other broad and non-exclusionary means of providing information to the public. The other thing that was really important to the proposed rule was the issue of timing. And Reg FD creates the difference between what it calls an intentional public disclosure and a non-intentional public disclosure. And under the rule, if there's an intentional public disclosure, then the issuer's requirement is to disclose the same information simultaneously. And if you stop and think about that, what does that mean? Well, that means that you really can't make a selective disclosure, because if you have to at the same time disclose it to everyone else in the world, it's not selective anymore. With respect to a non-intentional disclosure, the rule instead said that the issuer had to make that disclosure promptly afterwards. So that was to deal with a situation where there was an accidental, negligent, non-intentional disclosure. The issuer realized it afterwards, and the rule was designed to say that the curative measure was to disclose as promptly as possible. And that was the basic approach. As we got toward proposal, I think we certainly understood that there was going to be a lot of attention and a lot of controversy about this rule. People who industry groups, security bar members who knew about it, did find it somewhat revolutionary, somewhat unusual way to get at this issue. I'm trying to recall. I don't recall if we had meetings with people before proposals. Certainly as soon as it was proposed, we had a lot of requests for meetings from all corners, people who were telling us, well, you may think this is simple, but it's not really that simple. So I think kind of this part of the story gets us to proposal. At this point, maybe I'll pause and let Stuart take over to talk about some of the reaction to the proposal.
Sure. Thank you. You guys make it easy to pick up the thread of the story, so thanks. So I actually think I may have gotten a phone call from the SEC saying that this was percolating and didn't want anyone to feel blindsided, which was a very courteous thing to do. And, of course, the process went through elaborate notice and comment and all that. But it gave us a chance to really think about what was going on here and to do some careful consultation with our members, retain counsel, then think about it in a careful way. And the idea, well, who can possibly be against something that's called fair disclosure and tries to level the playing field? It was a quote that I had in an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal that said, well, the playing field will be more level, but it will be empty. And our concern was that by restricting the ability of senior management to talk except under very limited circumstances, that the rule would actually have the reverse effect of encouraging the flow of information. We thought it would actually end up insulating corporate management from penetrating questions from experts like securities analysts, and that the phone calls, the conference calls, and the meetings would become very pro forma, and there would be very little opportunity to probe and to ask hard questions, because an analyst might not even get an opportunity to be in the meeting. But even if there were such meetings, it would be very easy for a CEO or CFO to say, sorry, I can't talk to that, because if I get too far beyond what's in our press release, then that will put me in violation of Reg FD, and we're not going to do that. And that was sort of the centerpiece of our concern. It did turn out to be quite a close vote at the commission. Chairman Leavitt, of course, was the primary mover with Harvey Goldschmidt's great legal expertise. Commissioner Unger was opposed, and Commissioner Eichhundt had reservations, but ultimately he voted with the chairman in favor of the proposal. So our concerns, and we got into this in our letter, we kind of had two levels of concern with the proposal. And the first, as I say, was we thought it would diminish the flow of information to investors, that it would be counterproductive. Second, we thought it was really inconsistent with the whole statutory scheme of the 33 and 34 Acts, which did not mandate complete parity of access to material information, that it would undermine roadshows and capital raising. It would complicate the 8K process enormously. And it was unrealistic, because we thought that the idea that you could create an entirely level playing field with all investors finding out the same information at the same time just was not practical. The other thing that we felt, this was a little bit later on after the FD discussion, was that this really wasn't the issue that we should all be focusing on at all, that the bigger problem was actually securities analysts issuing overly optimistic research reports in the hope of getting future investment banking business. It didn't make me particularly popular when I would ask this question, but SIA did late in the game, but we did come out with sound practices to try to separate the analysts from the banking function, and those ideas ended up being in SRO rules and then what is now in Section 15D of the Exchange Act and Sarbanes-Oxley. And we really thought that was a much more important issue rather than the equal disclosure. And I think Chairman Leavitt ultimately acknowledged that he wished he had done more on that front. The second level of concerns that we had was we thought that notwithstanding the effort to draft the proposal carefully, that it would sweep in many legitimate conversations. What was the definition of a senior official? Would anybody involved in the discussion of the business be swept up in it? If you made a mistake, would it hurt your eligibility for shelf registrations in Rule 144? And the SEC didn't think much of our first set of comments, but they read carefully the second set, and we, along with, of course, many others, made similar comments about that we think there need to be adjustments, and the adopting release goes through and in detail says we heard this comment that we, you know, for example, need to narrow the scope so it doesn't apply to every communications with an issuer or every kind of personnel, and it addressed the shelf registration and the Rule 144 issue and so on. And so on that score, I think we and others made points that the commission was receptive hearing, but nonetheless, on the thrust of it, SIA was not successful in turning the ship. And then just as one final footnote to my little role in the story, about a year after the adoption. I testified in the House before the Capital Markets Subcommittee before the chairman, who turned out to be my future boss, and said, well, SIA no longer opposes the rule, but we do want to continue to work to ensure that information flows because we are seeing things in the market that we are troubled. We don't think analysts are getting all the information they need, and we want to see if we can be helpful in that regard. I'm not sure an awful lot came of that suggestion, but that was an effort to show that, you know, we were trying to be graceful losers and work to further the process of getting information to investors. So I will now turn it back over.
This is Dave. I guess one interesting thing I would note about the rulemaking process around Regulation FD is that in addition to the thoughtful comment letters that SIA provided, certain other organizations like SIA, there were many, many just individual investor letters that were written. And I think the comment count was like 6,000 or something like that, individual comment letters that were submitted to the commission. And it's interesting, I think, just as a historical reference in that it touched people in that way of you know, whether it was through a letter writing campaign or otherwise, in terms of, you know, the people thought, well, gee, this makes sense because why should we be disadvantaged in the flow of information? And now we're home, you know, day trading or the like at the time. And, you know, how can the commission not require this type of outcome? A lot of those letters were in support. And certainly that set the stage, you know, over the years where we've seen a lot more of those sort of individual comment letters coming in as opposed to just the ones from the law firms and the industry organizations and you know, sort of affected entities.
Yes, and as a steward, I got my first hate mail as a result of my representation of the industry. Yeah. But I was a big boy, and I still am.
Yeah, you're definitely right, Dave. I mean, it was, I think it was the first rulemaking like that for the SEC, where we had kind of like this huge populist outburst of letters in support of taking the rulemaking action. It was kind of funny. I mean, we really devoted a lot of staff time just trying to keep up with counting all the letters and making sure we looked at everything, and they were still coming in, you know, up to the day of the meeting. And actually, I just looked and I realized we were still getting comment letters for like years afterwards. I guess if I also can come back to something Stuart said about the SIA's comments and similar comments we got. You know, I think you can fairly say, and it sounded like Stuart sort of agreed, that this was a case where the system worked pretty well, in that we put the proposal out and the objections were, you know, kind of two, as I said, of two different, at two different levels. One is, this is just a really bad idea, don't do it, which we did not ultimately agree with. But then there were the much more particularized comments about, well, and if you're going to do it, you know, you have to cut back here, you have to fix this, you have to be aware of this problem. And those were comments that, you know, when we heard them, we kind of said, oh, yeah, well, that makes sense. You know, I had said the proposal said, you know, any disclosure to any person. And that's what a lot of the particular comments were about. We're saying, well, wait, you can't really mean that. You can't mean a disclosure to any person. You can't really mean like talking to the media. You can't mean kind of this business communications to suppliers or companies you're doing business with. And that led to, you know, fairly discreet amendments to the final rule that took those comments into account and, you know, allowed us to be more focused on the types of communications that we really were concerned about. Communications to securities professionals, communications to institutional investors, the types of communications that could lead to trading and suspicious market movements that were things that we didn't want to see and that investors didn't want to see.
And you know, as an advocate from the outside, there's always the dilemma of, well, if you say we don't like it, but by the way, here are things you could do to make it less objectionable. Are you sending a signal that says, well, we could live with it if we had to? And we were pretty clear that we were not trying to send that signal. And of course, you know, the commission, as we both said, didn't accept that suggestion. But it is a dilemma for anybody in this kind of advocacy role of saying, if you start to identify your specific objections in addition to the policy ones, and the SEC or the Congress or whoever starts to address them, you've basically taken away a lot of your own arguments. And we felt that we had to do that, one, because we thought there was a high probability of the rule going through, and two, at some point you say, well, we're going to be good citizens and say these are things that you have to fix if you go forward with it, even if we're not thrilled with what you're doing. So we did that.
Well, and certainly I can say from the staff side, that's a much more helpful type of comment. I think, you know, particularly in this situation, it was hard for us to kind of, to fathom all these comment letters that came in and said, oh, yes, of course, this is a really bad practice. We're not defending this. People should not be doing this. We're all in agreement. There should be, like, codes of conduct. There should be guidance. There should be voluntary approaches to preventing this from happening. But you shouldn't have a rule that says you can't do it. And that's just, that was not an argument that I think was moving the people. Obviously, it moved a few commissioners, but it was not an argument that was really going to persuade people who thought this was a problem. Whereas saying, well, whoa, wait a minute, you know, your rule just like brings in types of conduct that you don't really mean to bring in is, you know, obviously the type of thing that we were much more likely to be responsive to.
Great. Well, that's really helpful, I think, to understand just how the rulemaking came about and sort of the opposing views and ultimately how the final rule was adopted. And Linda, I guess the next phase of any rulemaking initiative is now rules are on the books and they have to be enforced. And, you know, you don't always have a lot of framework on which to construct an enforcement program around the rule, you know, just given the lack of prior experiencing and dealing with something like this. And so I'd be interested in hearing how enforcement looked at this rule at the time and then how it proceeded with coming up with ways to enforce it in an appropriate manner.
Sure. Thanks, Dave. And, you know, enforcement, to my mind, was ideally situated when FD was passed because the division director was, as has been mentioned, Dick Walker, who had a long history in the general counsel's office and otherwise. So he was sort of the perfect calming voice, if you will, as we launched into an FD enforcement process. And I wouldn't go so far as to call it a program because I think we all knew in our heart of hearts that the community that was likely to find itself below the V in an FD case was the kind of community that likes to comply with the law. They might not like it when it gets enacted. They might fight it, but they were going to comply, find some way to do it. So what Dick did for the first year or so was hit the speaking circuit. And his themes were, this is not a trap for the unwary. You know, we're only going after the most egregious violations, et cetera, to build momentum and support for the idea that that FD was addressing a real problem. And he also spent a fair amount of time talking about, as we've alluded to here, the tension between rulemaking versus enforcement. And because anytime you enact a rule, there are going to be a group of those who respond to it who say, you know, you really don't need a rule here. You've already got the tools. Just use an enforcement action. A rule is too broad. It cuts too deeply. It has unintended consequences. And conversely, if you were to go ahead and use the enforcement tools that we had, which were already quite broad, the response would inevitably be, this is rulemaking by enforcement. Nobody knew that this was a problem, and you should have done a regulation. So Dick spent a good year trying to sort of placate, if you will, the world and say that, you know, the world has not come to an end. And while that was going on, I think companies, by and large, kicking and screaming or reluctantly or whatever, decided to engage in practices where they could be in compliance. So the function of investor relations was even more professionalized. People thought through how to do this. How companies interacted with analysts changed as a result of FD. So that was those were some of the initial steps. Just about 2 years after the rule was adopted, the first FD cases were brought. And there were, you know, a group of them all brought within a relatively short period of time. And they tended to be the precise kinds of behaviors that had been talked about in the rulemaking process. Conversations with analysts, planned conversations with analysts, and got a fair amount of attention at the time. The one thing, my favorite of all of those cases, was one, which wasn't an actual case, but rather a 21A report, which was directed at a company, I think it was Motorola, that added information that was directionally the same as information that it already provided to the markets generally, but was more specific. But before doing so, they had consulted with counsel and had counsel's advice. And that, while that's not a defense, it frequently works in terms of, you know, the SEC is an agency of lawyers. And I think the notion that if you were in good faith trying to comply, people would look carefully at conduct. And then after those cases, there were relatively few. And there have been some since, and there is some, you know, it's difficult to enforce. And I think by and large, it is, as I said, it's an area where the potential defendants who are institutions and entities that are inclined to try to work within the system and according to the rules, who don't like the idea of a public company finding itself at odds with the SEC. So the rule, I think, is generally complied with. You know, as we look back, and again, I'd be interested, especially in what Stuart and Dave have to say about this, the companies that I think the commission and the enforcement staff always worry about in this context and others are those, if you will, relatively new public companies, the smaller public companies, public companies that are led by iconic founders who haven't fully embraced, who love the idea of going to the market, but don't fully embrace the responsibilities that come with being a public company.
Yeah, I think that's the kind of compliance situation that people run into that makes it sort of difficult when you, because you can't be in the room at all times if you're in-house at a company or outside counsel, and you try to explain these principles and try to administer best practices, and all of that can be for naught if somebody is just feels compelled to communicate in a way that, you know, isn't consistent with Regulation FD. I think that makes it a much more difficult type of compliance environment. But I think you're absolutely right in the sense that, you know, public companies have a lot of obligations already, and when this obligation was added, it certainly changed the landscape considerably, but it, you know, changed it in a way that I think ultimately people accepted and found a way to create the systems and the controls that allowed it to proceed and allow their communications to proceed and change their communications and IR approach in a way that ultimately, I think, benefited investors.
This is Stuart. I mean, one of the things that the Commission struggles with today is trying to make sure that companies choose to go public. And I think the last statistics I saw, it's about 50-50, half and half, as to which companies go the public route and which prefer to use private financing. And I can't say that I think that FD was the tipping point that caused companies to choose not to be public as opposed to and raise money privately. But I think if you are a corporate manager, you have to look at the whole panoply of responsibilities that you undertake if you want to go to the public markets. And, of course, private investors are also entitled to the anti-fraud protections. But there's a lot more to do. And as I say, I can't say that I know that FD is high on that list of things that you would consider as a manager, as a issuer, but it has to be on your list. And we want the public markets, because of the people who are investing, to have a fair shake and to know what's going on and get the material information and all that. But we also don't want all the good opportunities to be in the private market. And I worry that sometimes you could stray in that direction. And the Commission is trying diligently to balance that. And it's not an easy balance.
Don, I guess that brings us to what the assessment of FD is today in the, you know, development of it in the rulemaking process, mm-hmm. or things such as, you know, sort of that chilling effect that was mentioned, that was raised. Other people have said, you know, it could lead to sort of information overload. I think some people were concerned it was going to upend the periodic and current disclosure system that we know and love in the United States and replace it with a sort of ad hoc disclosure system that other jurisdictions employ. How did it all play out ultimately?
Sure, and it's always hard to know, because if you go back to 2000 and look plus or minus 2 or 3 years before or after, so many other things changed in the world of securities regulation. Sarbanes-Oxley, obviously, being one of the big ones. The Elliott-Spitzer driven settlements and reforms that Stuart mentioned. Knowing exactly what did FD do, as opposed to 10 or 20 or 30 other effects on the market, is always difficult. So let me start out by giving you an academic's perspective, because it turns out financial economists love to study Reg FD, put Reg FD in our search engines for financial economics, and it spews out an incredibly large number. So some highlights, there is a lot of support for the notion that initially it worked. You know, I think the combination of the rule and Dick Walker going out on the road, initially the story is it had a positive effect. And one of the things that people pointed out is there were now larger rewards going to analysts who worked harder, the ones who actually did number crunching as opposed to pick up the telephone and call a friend inside the issuer. Those were things that were happening where market efficiency was said to benefit. There was also a chill because, in the end, there are so many gray areas associated with the definition of material non-public information. Another interesting study, and a number of people have taken different angles on this, in 2005, I think it was, there was a significant loss for the commission in a case called SEC versus Siebel, which was the most important judicial pushback against FD and against an elastic interpretation of what it means to convey material non-public information. And there's evidence that, you know, before and after the case that slapped down the commission for the winks and nods type of argument, trading got a little bit more aggressive, and there probably were more people engaging in gray area conduct than there had been before. You know, I think if you look at the whole story of enforcement, yes, the message is there, and most people in the securities industry want to do the right thing. But if you're the kind of person who gets tempted not to do the right thing, the enforcement record under Reg FD is not entirely scary. And the last thing I'll say, and this probably deserves an exclamation point, is in the 20 years since Reg FD, technology has obliterated whatever sense of the possibility of a level playing field people might once have thought of. That, you know, there's a what was used to be called question and answer, compliance and disclosure interpretation now. Can you simultaneously send a private message and the filing to the SEC? And we can quibble about exactly what simultaneous means, but, you know, can there be essentially simultaneous public and private disclosures? And the answer is yes. And if somebody has machine learning and algorithmic instructions going, there's no way that the public disclosure will reach the human mind in time to compete with the professionals. We know that now we're in less than a second adjustments to new information in the current world. And so bottom line is I think Reg FD was a very positive brand message transmission about what we hope for and what we want to be in the American securities markets. But in the end, things like technology and resources do have a habit of overwhelming even the best of intentions.
It is an excellent point. And on the technology point, there was one aspect of it that I thought made sense to sort of round out the story in terms of the development of the rule and its interpretation over time. And that is really the thought that, as hard as it is to remember back in 2000 when the rule was adopted, you know, we were really at the dawn of the internet age. People were still having to dial up to get their internet access and the like. And so, you know, the information transfer via the internet was something that the commission obviously noted in the adopting release and talked about how that was changing the dynamic by which issuers chose to disclose information, but it ultimately left open the question of to what extent the internet could be used as a means to adequately publicly disseminate information so that it was, in fact, no longer non-public. And, you know, when you think back to a world of, you know, publication in the Wall Street Journal and the like as sort of, and then, you know, the issuance of press releases as sort of the hallmarks of widespread public dissemination, it seems kind of quaint today and looking back at that and that, you know, people, you know, all the way up the chain use things like Twitter, Twitter and other social media channels to communicate information, and companies regularly use their websites to communicate a lot of information that includes material information. And in fact, recognizing that the commission had left that open back in 2000, subsequently in 2008, the commission reconsidered the question of the extent to which the company could use its website as a means to disseminate information and provided some interpretive guidance around that in terms of the parameters that would need to be applied. And then subsequently, in the Netflix 21A report, the commission addressed sort of applying those same standards in the context of social media channels as well. So, you know, to some extent, I think it's important to just recognize that FD evolved over time in the way it was interpreted and how public dissemination could be accomplished through those subsequent commission actions.
Yeah, David, at the certainly at the time, I recall there were a lot of suggestions about the commission should be explicit about saying certain types of things were good enough, you know, whether saying whether an internet transmission was good enough or a webcast of a conference call was good enough. And I don't, as I kind of remember it, and when I look back at the way we wrote it, I think we at least, you know, we had the foresight to know, well, we didn't want to write down into the rule what was good enough today, because we could at least see that technology was changing pretty quickly and that, you know, whether something was good enough today wasn't necessarily going to tell you whether it was going to, whether there might be a better way next year or whether something that hadn't been developed yet was going to come along that was going to be better than what you could do today. So we certainly at least, you know, wrote the rule to try to leave open this notion that there could be a variety of ways that could achieve effective public simultaneous non-exclusionary disclosure. But having said all that, I have to concede Don's point, which is there are other ways in which technology has just, you know, way surpassed the types of things that we were really thinking about trying to address.
Yeah, I think it's always a difficult challenge in the rulemaking process to write a rule that can stand the test of time. And here we're talking about a rule that has stood the test of 20 years of very radical changes to the way the markets work and the way information is disseminated and the way in which companies interact with their analysts and investors and the like. Well, with that, I think we've covered the territory we hope to cover in terms of the development and implementation of Regulation FD, and I want to thank everyone for all those insights.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Pleasure.